This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm here in our Lexington, Kentucky studio on this frigid Tuesday evening. Of course, I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. Thank you to everyone joining us tonight on Sirius 220, XM 206, as well as to those listening on our website at horseracingradio.net. Now, I know I talk about this a lot, but please don't forget those riders who have given everything to the sport. We strongly support the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF is a great organization that helps permanently disabled riders. If you are able to help, please go to pdjf.org and donate. Now, I am honored to introduce tonight's guest. She shattered one record after another. Not only was she arguably the best female jockey to ever sit on the back of a horse, but one of the top riders of our generation. She won the Kentucky Oaks twice, 2 Breeders' Cup victories, 1,877 career wins, and over $71 million in earnings. Rosina Pravnik, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Christina. It's great to be on here.
So excited about this. This hour is going to be fantastic. And to start things off here, a lot of people are at least familiar with your background story, and we'll get to that. But let's first talk about Rosie today. Tell us about the transition to motherhood and your son, Carson.
Well, I think all in all, the transition to motherhood is probably much easier for me than a lot of people thought it would be. I retired from racing because I wanted to start a family of my own and add to the family of my husband and his stepdaughter. And so we really had planned that out, and I was just ready to do that. And I am just enjoying it more than I could have possibly imagined.
That's fantastic. Tell us about your son.
Carson is just about 7.5 months old. He is an incredible little baby. He's just, people have asked me, actually in other interviews during Breeders' Cup, actually, they asked me, what's the most surprising thing about motherhood? And I didn't really have a great answer for it. But I realized that the most surprising thing is how easy it is. And every mother in the universe might hate me for saying that, because obviously it's not easy, but he is like such an agreeable baby. He's so happy all the time, super sociable, and just so much fun.
I have to say that answer does surprise me. I know I was not a very easy baby, my mother will tell you, but that is great news, Rosie. And I hope it's safe to say, according to Twitter, August 2016 will be very eventful for you.
Yes. We are actually expecting another child who should be arriving in early August. And that's probably a little sooner than we were planning. But, we were always planning to have a second child. And I'm excited that they'll be very close in age, because I had a very close relationship with my older brother, who's 2 years older. But these two will be actually 14 months apart. So
very close.
It will be busy in August.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And do you know the gender yet?
We won't be able to find that out until, I think, late February.
Sure. Are you hoping for a boy or a girl?
You know, I don't really know. I kind of feel like it would be nice to have a girl, but Carson is so easy and agreeable, and I'm kind of like a little bit of a guy's girl, so I wouldn't mind having another son.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Now,
I've always gotten along really well with guys, well, believe it or not.
Well, believe it or not,
and
folks.
And I was, as a child, like a horrible terror. So I feel like, especially considering how good Carson is, if I were to have a girl, it could be like payback time. But having said that, it would be, I would be really happy with either. I really was hoping for a boy the first time. And so I would be very happy with either.
Now, here's a question for you. Do you think, does Carson, I know it's very early to say, but does he show interest in horses? Do you think he might follow in your footsteps one day?
Well, he's got plenty of different routes he could go if he likes horses. He does show interest in horses, actually. I mean, all animals, really. He's been exposed to quite a bit. He's very well-traveled. He's been to the barn. You know, we have four dogs at home right now, three of our own and one foster dog from the SPCA. So he gets plenty of animal interaction, and he loves it. So, but, you know, I take him to the barn all the time, and he reaches up and pets the horses, and he loves, actually, at the moment, I'm at, Joe and I are at Palm Meadows Training Center, and we're staying in one of the apartments they have for the trainers here, which is, like, located right on the track. It's this magnificent facility. But we walk out the door in the morning, and we can stand on the balcony and watch the horses train, and he'll sit on my knee and, like, literally his head just goes left to right to left to right to left to right, and he just watches the horses train all morning, and he could just sit there and do it forever.
Wow.
So he has shown a little bit of interest in the horses, and but I mean, I think animals all around he's pretty intrigued by, and you know, that's kind of what Joe and I are all about. We're always doing animals and pet things and outside things, so he's been exposed to quite a lot.
Well, he's already won a Breeders' Cup, so it would make sense if he were to go on and pursue a riding career. But Palm Meadows, so I have to say I'm a little bit jealous. It's freezing here in Kentucky. But
well, it's not that much nicer, actually, here in Boynton Beach. This is my second time coming down to Palm Meadows, and it's been either cold or raining or both.
Oh, no.
Every day I've been here, so.
I'm imagining you're on the beach and.
Well, we actually went to the beach yesterday, but it was cold and windy, so.
Well, that's no fun. Okay, well, I'm not so jealous now. But.
Yeah, no, it's not all cracked up to be this Florida thing, but no, but it is being here at Palm Meadows, and the training is fabulous, and it's a nice place to be.
Really quickly, I want to touch on something you just mentioned. You said the number of dogs you have. I heard that you rescue dogs. Is that right?
Joe and I each had a dog when we met, and then we started fostering for the SPCA when we bought our house in New Orleans. And we only do the fostering over the winter because it's probably the least travel. Well, up until this year, it was the least traveling, so we were home most of the time. But, yeah, we do, like, a fast-track foster from the SPCA. So we take dogs that are, you know, up for adoption in the shelter, and they may be, like, really shy and not presenting themselves well on the adoption floor and need some socialization, things like that. Or, you know, if they need some medical care, so, you know, we had one dog who had burns on him, and so he needed to grow back his hair before anybody would look at him and think, oh, he's cute and I'll like to adopt him. So we've adopted, I think, 11 dogs now over the years, and we've only kept one. So
oh, wow.
Doing pretty good. But yeah, it's just, we're just animal people, and it's pretty fun. So it keeps everything new and fresh all the time. Although I wasn't a huge fan of fostering one this year, having a newborn and being pregnant. But Joe brought this lovely beagle home to foster, so we have Bernie the Beagle at the moment.
Bernie the Beagle has joined the family.
He is up for adoption, just in case anybody's looking in the New Orleans area.
Well, folks, you heard it. So if you want a beagle, there you go. You also are very involved in retired racehorses, and of course, Old Friends here in Kentucky is a wonderful, wonderful program. Talk about your involvement with that.
Yeah, I've been involved with a few of the racehorse retirement or rehoming organizations. I'm on the board of Old Friends, which is one of the most fabulous organizations run by, founded by Michael Blowen, who is, I would say, if not the most genuine person involved in racing that I have ever met. He runs a fabulous organization in Georgetown, Kentucky, at the Old Friends facility, and they're expanding, buying new property, putting up new fencing. There's lots of funding going on all the time for the Old Friends, but it's a fabulous organization. I mean, you drive down the driveway at Old Friends, and you're, like, surrounded by all of these champion racehorses, and it's really incredible. I mean, I'm not even old enough to appreciate some of them. They're so much older than I am. Retired stallions are the only organization that retires stallions, and now they've had more and more horses coming back from overseas who were, you know, champion racehorses in this country and then had gone over to breed in Japan and other places. We have Silver Charm. We just got, I'm trying to think. We've gotten so many just recently. So there's lots of new additions at the farm, stallions that have been retired from stud and come back from overseas. So there's over 100 horses. Wow. You know, there's always a waiting list and more on the list. And Michael just does such an amazing job with these horses. He's very hands-on. You know, he feeds them every day himself, and he he does the tours himself. So he is just really a great person and doing a great job with a great cause.
I couldn't agree with you more. Michael Blowen is one of the best people in the industry, without a doubt. Now, Rosie, you also returned to the saddle for the TCA Thoroughbred Makeover. Tell us about that.
I'm actually also on the board of the Retired Racehorse Project. And in 2015 was the first year that they had, I think it was their third makeover. And they had it at the horse park this past year, the weekend before Breeders' Cup. So it was a really fabulous competition. Stuart Pittman is the head of the Retired Racehorse Project. He's another incredible person and does an amazing, amazing job being involved with some of these programs. I'm thinking to myself, like, I don't know how, you know, they set off to create these things, and there's so much involved to get it all put together, and they've done such a great job. The makeover was run so well last year. It's gotten so big. They had, I think they ended up with maybe roughly 200 entries. I mean, at one point, wow, they had four and then 400, and they scratched down quite a bit. And obviously the competition is very new, and especially since it's becoming so big so quickly, there's a lot of things that are still changing and improving. 2016 is going to be a really great competition as well. But I did, Stuart actually called me last winter when I was in New Orleans and said, you know, we would like to have you as part, you know, what do you want to do for the makeover? You know, there's all kinds of different things we could do. And he said, you know, you could even train a horse. And I was like, well, ding, 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 that's what I want to do, more than anything else. So I set off to try to find a horse to train. And I was like, well, what if I could get, you know, a really well-known retired horse and train it? I mean, that would be basically the biggest showcase you could possibly have for an off-track thoroughbred, is, you know, a famous, well-accomplished horse that's won champion races. So I actually gave Michael Blowen a call because they had just acquired Game On Dude to the farm. And I said, what if we retrain Game On Dude to, you know, be an off-track horse just for the showcase? I mean, not that he would have a second, you know, wouldn't be a big second career for him, because obviously he's kind of retired. But
right.
So I kind of knew it was going to be a fail, and he asked Bob Baffert about it. No.
No.
Every training game on two. So I thought that would have been really cool, but I knew it was kind of a long shot. So anyway, but I hooked up with, and Stuart hooked me up with Susanna Thomas, who is the head of this Maker's Mark Secretariat Center, which is located on the horse park. And they run a retraining and rehoming facility, and they were looking for people to train horses that come from their facility to promote their facility. So they were kind of looking for trainers, riders, and I was looking for someone to sort of share the project with, because I was becoming more and more pregnant and obviously wasn't able to do too much riding in the spring. So the Secretariat Center and I did a joint training effort, and we came across a horse called Dare Me, who I competed in the makeover. The Secretariat Center did most of the training. And I, after my son was born and we got back from Saratoga, I, you know, took over the majority of the riding competition-wise and started competing him and, you know, getting to know the horse. And he had most of his training under the care of Dorothy Crowell, who is an amazing, amazing event rider that I had the pleasure to spend a lot of time with and learn a lot from. So we did the joint training effort and competed, and he is a top class off track horse and very valuable, worth a lot of money, and so it was a great showcase for the off track thoroughbreds. But the entire competition was run; it was very successful, and I was very glad to be a part of it. I had so much fun. It was a lot to put on my own plate, I realized once I was in the midst of it with having Carson too. But it was a lot of fun, and looking forward, I probably won't train a horse this year because I've got kind of a lot going on, but I'll definitely be part of the makeover, and it's going to be another great competition. So really great for the off-track thoroughbreds. Great, great organization, the Retired Racehorse Project.
Oh, and it's so great that you're so involved with that. Now, how old was Carson when you actually competed?
The competition was in October, so he was like about 4.5 months, almost 5 months.
And that was a pretty quick comeback to the saddle, I would say.
Yeah, well, I have also my own off-track thoroughbred who I've had for, let's see, like 8 years now, a little over 8 years. And I had leased him out over the summer while I was at Saratoga, so I knew I wouldn't have any time to ride him and for energy, for that matter. But I got back from Saratoga, and I got him back, and 4 days later, I took him to an event, which was right down the road from us, and we were quite unprepared, but we came out pretty well and actually got a ribbon. So I made a little bit of a rush comeback for my event, my eventing fantasy career.
Well, it all worked out good though, sounds like.
Yeah, no, I just had a lot of fun this fall with my horse and with Dare Me, the makeover horse, and just was really great to get back into the eventing world, and I met tons of new people and lots of new connections, and you know, it's kind of really inspired me to, you know, work toward getting into that, you know, involving myself more with, you know, my own thing. But, you know, I still now have even more going on than I expected.
Well,
so we'll get to that when we get to that.
Keeping
but,
busy.
It's definitely a passion of mine, and I have a lot of fun, and having my own horse is really great, so.
Now, your mother actually trained event horses in New Jersey, is that right?
Yes. Yes, I grew up eventing. So, I mean, a lot of people, when I did the makeover especially, were like, oh, my gosh, you can jump too. And I'm like, well, yeah, I was actually did this before I was a jockey. So, but, yeah, I grew up on a farm in New Jersey, in Bedminster, New Jersey, and my mom trained and coached event horses, and she had a bunch of students, and you know, that's what we did growing up, and the conditioning, we got into the racing. I was 7 years old when I did my first pony race, but I evented until I was, I think, 12 or so, and I always loved it, but the dressage part of the eventing is kind of what turned me off. I always say the dressage is the reason I became a jockey,
I have to agree
with
you.
I was more interested in the going fast and having fun, so that's how I got into racing.
Yeah, dressage, I didn't even try that. That was too slow for me.
Exactly.
Way too slow. I want to ask you a question really quickly, Rosie, just because it's intrigued me. You were born in Medham, New Jersey. Sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly, but you weren't born in a hospital.
Yes, it was actually, I was born in Medham, New Jersey, and I was born accidentally at my grandmother's house.
Oops.
So I was just very ambitious from the very beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, yeah, that had to be very interesting for your mother. That's quite the introduction to the world.
Yeah, I think actually I'm still maybe the only person ever to be born in Medham. On record, anyway.
On record. So at 7 years old, you had your first pony race. Did you decide then and there that you wanted to be a jockey?
Yes, absolutely.
There was no doubt in your mind?
There was no doubt. And I didn't even know what that even meant. Like, I didn't have any exposure to horse racing, to like the racetrack. The pony races are held at the steeplechase meets, like in the Delaware Valley area, tri-state area. So we had exposure to the steeplechasing, but not quite to the flat track. And the only real influence I had into flat racing was a video called The Jewels of the Triple Crown, which I would love to get my hands on these days because I haven't seen it since I was, you know, probably 10. But I used to watch this video, and it was just, you know, it was a documentary about all the Triple Crown winners and, you know, their stories and stuff. And, I mean, I had this thing, I had it memorized. We didn't have television when I was a kid. We just had, you know, a TV set and a VCR. So there was plenty of VHS tapes that I watched over and over and over again. But this was one of my favorites for sure. And I had, I mean, at one point I could have told you the Triple Crown winners in order and their, you know, the year and the story of all of them. Probably can't do that now. But it was just, you know, it as a kid, it just totally turned me on, and I was wanted to do that. And my sister was she's 6 years older than I am. She was always more into steeplechasing, but I always was more attracted to the flat racing. And so she became a steeplechase trainer, and I became a jockey on the flat track.
Jockey Rosie Napravnik joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So Rosie, your older sister went the steeplechase route. How did you get introduced to the track?
Well, my sister, being older, she actually graduated high school early when she was 17 and went off to work for Bruce Miller. And like I said, she was always in the steeplechasing, so that was sort of her dream come true. And so she moved out early and moved to Unionville, Pennsylvania, where the steeplechasing is aplenty there. And she worked for Bruce. She worked for a few other people. And I think a few years after that, maybe a year or two later, I went to work for the summer. And I can't remember. She had just left Pennsylvania and got a new job in Butler, Maryland, but had already set me up with a job for Jonathan Shepherd galloping. And a lot of the trainers knew us from pony racing because we were very competitive and we ended up winning a lot. So,
Imagine that.
And a lot of the steeplechase trainers, actually, they have a small, medium, large divisions of the pony races, and then they have the junior horse races. And so it wasn't uncommon for some of the big trainers to put their, you know, their good steeplechase horses in the junior flat races as like a, you know, a prep in the beginning of the season, or, you know, like a breeze basically. And they would recruit like some of the good junior riders to ride their horses in the junior races because you had to be under 16 or 18 or something. So a lot of the trainers knew the, you know, the pony racing riders. And so I got a job with, my sister set me up with a job for Jonathan Shepherd. And he was my first galloping job. I was 13, and I worked for him on the farm in Unionville. And then the next summer, my sister had moved to Maryland and was working for Jack Fisher. So that summer, I worked for Jack Fisher, which was a crazy job, so much fun. Really, I mean, if I hadn't learned how to ride yet, I'd certainly learn at Jack Fisher's because it's wild. But the connection with Jonathan, I never knew would benefit me so much in later years. He was actually the first Breeders' Cup I ever rode with for Jonathan. So it's, you know, it all comes back around. It surely does. And so when, I guess the next summer, my sister had, she was in need of a new job and kind of quickly. And so she ended up getting a job helping at the racetrack, which was, she was going to college at Towson University in Maryland. And, you know, it was just kind of a quick job. It was supposed to be a temporary thing for her because she was obviously more into the steeple chasing. But it was, you know, couldn't have been a better situation for me. I was so excited because I got to go to the racetrack and kind of follow her around. So when I was 16, I got my galloping license at the track, my exercising license, and she set me up with a job for Dickie Small. And that was my first galloping job, first and only, actually, galloping job on the racetrack before I got my jockey license when I was 17.
We'll be right back. We'll talk about trainer Dickie Small and what a great influence he was. After this short commercial break, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, fifth generation ink, distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the third annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF coming to Gulfstream Park on Sunday, February 28th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Ping Kai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com. Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. First, let's head to New York, where Jose Ortiz had a great week by leading North America in earnings and tied for most wins. He capped off the week with a win in the Interboro Stakes aboard La Verdad. Ortiz finished the week with 8 wins, 3 seconds, and 2 third-place finishes. Gerard Melanson had another consistent week at Delta Downs as he won 44% and came in the money on 69% of his mounts. G-Money finished the week with 7 wins, 3 seconds, and 1 third-place finish. Russell Bays continued dominating Northern California and tied Trevor McCarthy and Jose Ortiz for the lead in wins in North America. For the week, Bays finished with 8 wins, 5 seconds, and 2 third-place finishes. Finally, our Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Javier Castellano, put on a show at Gulfstream as he won 2 of the 3 graded stakes on Saturday. Castellano led North America in stakes earnings and was second in total earnings. For the week, Castellano finished with 5 wins, 9 seconds, and 3 third-place finishes. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the perfect book for anyone who has wondered what it takes to be a professional jockey. The sport's most prominent jockeys and trainers tell their stories and share their insights on all that goes on behind the scenes. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all of the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Now Untappable comes to take them on. Rhea Antonia's running a big one. Something wrong with Close Hatches today. Close Hatches is gone at the top of the lane. And it's Untappable now up to take them on. Untappable, Aya Tapper battling back along the inside. And now here comes Don't Tell Sophia. Don't Tell Sophia coming fast. But it's Untappable in front. Untappable the leader. Don't Tell Sophia flying on the outside. Untappable's going to get there. Untappable has won it. Close for second, Io Tapper, and a flying Don't Tell Sophia. Then Rhea Antonia and Unbridled Forever.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christina McManigal, joined tonight by jockey Rosie Napravnik. And Rosie, right before we cut to commercial break, you mentioned trainer Richard Dickey Small, and unfortunately, he's recently passed away, but he was a legend in Maryland. I was fortunate enough to ride for him, and just what a mentor to have when you're only 16 years old. You're so young. What did Mr. Small teach you?
He was an amazing man for sure. It's funny, like, when you ask, you know, what did Dickie teach you? It wasn't like a matter of him sitting down and telling you things. It was basically just observing Dickie and the way he did things and listening to him tell stories. And, I mean, there's so much I learned from him. There's so much that I didn't even know I was learning from him. But when I was, you know, he was my first gallop job, I was just, it was unreal to me to even be galloping at the racetrack. I mean, I'd come from New Jersey where there was, you know, not anywhere near Monmouth Park. You know, I was never anywhere near racing. So just to be at the racetrack was amazing. And I probably didn't appreciate at the time, you know, what an incredible trainer Dickie was. I didn't know. I mean, I was told, but I probably couldn't appreciate it until, you know, later in my life. But he was amazing to work for. And I galloped with a guy named Jose Villegas, who was actually in recent years paralyzed at the racetrack. Still a good friend of mine, great rider, and taught me a lot about riding. And, you know, I first breached horses on the racetrack with him and breached horses out of the gate. But it was the most fun job. I mean, when I would go back at any point in my life and gallop for Dickie. It was just, you know, it was the most fun job I've ever had. And learned so much. I mean, just if you sit with Dickie for 5 minutes, he's been through so much life experience. It's incredible, and on and off the racetrack. But he was just a very intriguing person, and taught me so many things. So I wouldn't even know where to start. But also gave me, you know, my first and biggest opportunities on the racetrack as well. And I rode my first race for him, and I like one of the only claimers he had in the barn. And he took, I think Louis Garcia had won like 5 or 6 races on the filly, and he took Louis off so he could put me on. And it was like a mile and 16th race at Pimlico, and she went to the front and you know, was just the best horse in the race. And it was like my dream had already come true, you know, back in 2005. And I had, you know, I didn't really have any expectations at that time, but I certainly never imagined a career of what it ended up being.
Dickie actually told you when you first started riding to list your name in the program as A.R. Napravnik. Why was that?
Well, it was funny. I was actually with Dickie when when he went to the racing office to make the entry. And we're, like, walking on our way to the racing office, and he goes, so what's your name going to be? What are we going to call you? And I'm like, I don't know, Dickie. Like, what about my name? He's like, well, no, you can't use your real name, because then they'll know you're a girl. So he kept coming up, and he was like, well, what about Andy or this or that? I'm like, well, I mean, I'm cool with that, but I don't know if they're going to just let you pick a name and, and you know, put it in the entry box. So he's like, all right, well, we'll just use your initials. And I'm like, okay. Not that they're, you know, real great initials, A-R. But so that's what we ended up doing. And I just, you know, it didn't really, I thought it was, to me, I was like, boy, isn't this overkill? Like, you know, what century are we in? And is it really, you know, does it really matter? That was kind of the way I was thinking. But, you know, obviously, if Dickie thought that's what I should do, then obviously I should do that. So, and having said that, I think it absolutely served its purpose 1,000%. And, glad that's the way it was.
And A.R. Napravnik won her first race for Dickie Small. I believe it was June 2006.
No, June 2005.
June 2005. I was a year off. And you actually dropped out of high school, and you were only 17 years old?
Yes. I decided to, about 3 weeks before my junior year was over, I decided that I was going to quit and, you know, pursue my career. And those last 3 weeks of school were probably the longest in my life because I, you know, obviously I said, well, I better finish these so I can get the credits just in case I suck at being a jockey and I need to go back to school. So I finished those last 3 weeks of my junior year and I went off to Colonial Downs after I rode my first race at Pimlico. I think I rode maybe four races at Pimlico and then went to Colonial. And I had an agent named John Faltinsky, who's been everywhere in the country racing and done every job. But he was my agent, and he had me breathing or galloping any horse for any trainer on the backside. And it was a great hustle is what it was. And it taught me a lot. And I rode a lot of terrible, terrible horses in the morning and in the afternoon. But it certainly taught me a lot. I actually got to ride for Jonathan at that meet too. And it was my first real time out on my own. We were all down, everybody living in the Ramada Hotel at Colonial Downs, and it was definitely an experience. I think I ended up winning, you know, a little over a dozen races down there. And when I came back, you know, the whole Maryland racing community kind of goes to Colonial and then comes back to Laurel in the fall, and came back and was leading rider at Laurel Park in the fall before I had my first accident.
Well, the hard work paid off, Rosie, because you just dominated the standings in Maryland and won riding titles in 2006 at all meets at the major Maryland tracks. And you mentioned before your injury. So tell us what happened there.
My first injury was at Laurel. There was another bug rider who was in front of me, crossed over and clipped heels and fell, and I just was right behind him and fell over top of him. I broke my collarbone, and it was kind of I never really considered that I would get hurt, and so it was a good warm-up.
You well?
It was a good warm-up break for what was to come. First of many.
The first of many, you say. Describe the list of injuries.
That was in November of 2005. That was my first accident. I broke my collarbone. I was out for, I believe, 5.5 weeks. 2006 was my, thankfully, an injury-free year and was my bug year when I was up for the Eclipse Award and was the runner-up to Julian Lepreux. I won 300 races in 2006, so thankfully that was an injury-free, very prosperous year.
Wow.
January of 2007, I went down on a horse after the finish line at Laurel and compression fractured 3 vertebrae in my back and was off for 3 months. I came back from that in, I think, April, and I was back for a couple months. And then I went down a horse that broke down at Colonial Downs, and I displaced, fractured my left arm, and which was probably the most painful injury to that point, and I was off for, I believe, 4 months then. So I came back in November, and I rode, I think, the Laurel meet that winter, and what was the next one? I think the next one was in August of 2008. I was in a stake, riding a stake race for Hammy Smith, and was coming up the rail, and Mario Pino came over, and I went down and broke my leg. I actually hit the ground fine and didn't break anything, and then I was actually trampled by my second call, which was a main check only.
Oh, my goodness.
And I specifically remember the horse basically, like, galloping through my leg.
Yeah.
So I broke my tibia and fibula, displaced fractures. And that was a pretty crazy break for me because I literally broke my shin in half and had to relearn how to walk and all that. And that was kind of an eye-opener.
Wow.
But that was the one that made me realize after I thought, you know, I had things come in threes, so I thought I'd paid my dues and, you know, obviously I wouldn't get hurt anymore. And then, bam, there it goes again. So that was the one that made me realize it could happen any day on any horse. But that was, I was actually back on horse in just over 2 months. After having broken my leg in half, they inserted a rod in my tibia, and I had extensive physical therapy and really great doctors at Christiana Hospital in Delaware, and just an amazing recovery, fast recovery. I think I went a couple of years without injuries, and then on July 6th, which happened to be the same date I broke my arm the first time, I went down and broke my arm, the same arm, same injury, July 6th, 2011, 4 years later, and I basically had the same surgery. They removed the plate that they had put in the first time, and they actually couldn't get it out. So they had to cut the screw heads off, and the screws are still in my arm floating around.
Oh, wow.
And replace that plate with a new, bigger plate because my arm had broken off basically at the end of the plate, the first plate. So they plated that, put my arm back together. And when I woke up from that surgery, I was kind of like, this is not right. You know, I've had the same injury, same surgery, and this is not right. Something's not right. And the doctors kept telling me everything was fine. So a couple days later, they did some kind of test, and they realized that I had something called compartment syndrome. So I was in the hospital for 2.5 weeks for a broken arm, and it was probably the hardest 2.5 weeks of my life.
Couldn't wait.
I shouldn't say that, but it was definitely, it was rough, and it was very painful. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was at risk of losing my arm at one point. So that was definitely one of my worst injuries. And then, was that my last? No. Then it was June 2014. I think I went down in the morning. It was my only accident in the morning, and I separated my AC joint in my left shoulder. And that was probably the only injury I ever came back too soon from. And coincidentally, the only one that still bothers me. So there's a lesson there.
Too soon, according to you, maybe 2 months after learning how to walk again, you were back in the saddle before. That's, wow, a very long list of injuries. I'm a little bit squeamish now.
Yeah, but, yeah no, I was, but, you know, I really was always good about waiting, you know, until the doctor's advice to go back and really, you know, taking all the time that was needed to recover. And, you know, it allowed me to come back strong from each accident. I don't think I ever went through a slow period because of a layoff. I mean, I've gone through slow periods in my career, but I don't think you know, I've always come back strong from each injury and, you know, progress in my career. So,
well, come back strong you did from all of those, and didn't stop you. Most definitely, you killed the competition in Maryland, like I mentioned, and then in 2008, you began to ride regularly in New York.
Yeah, I rode two winters at Aqueduct, and those were pretty, they were winters at Aqueduct. They were miserable. But, you know, learned a lot there. It was my first introduction to New York racing, which is, sets itself apart from any other place, and for good reason. I mean, you have the elite trainers, elite horses in New York, and not necessarily during the winter when I was riding, but at least, you know, I was introduced to a lot of people and had the opportunity to ride for Todd Fletcher and Cameron McLaughlin and lots of other, you know, New York trainers that ended up, you know, riding for them at Saratoga years later. And Kieran, actually, you know, a lot of people wouldn't consider Kieran to be a big influence in my career, but he was the first trainer to really let me travel with a graded stakes horse, Reading Colliery. And, you know, it was kind of under the radar, one of the first things that really put me on the map of riding good races. So, to me, I mean, people ask me, like, what was your big breakthrough? And I can't really say I've had one, but I've had many. And that was really one of them for me to move to the next level and be in demand to ride, you know, some of the bigger races.
Well, you certainly continued to move up. And in 2010, you then began riding at Fairgrounds. And initially, that was a little bit difficult to establish yourself there, yes?
Yeah, you know, the move to Fairgrounds in itself was a pretty bold move, and, you know, a lot of people that, you know, knew me best at that time thought, you know, you're just trying to follow your boyfriend, who later became my husband, but, you know, and I did my best to convince him that that wasn't true, but it probably was. But I always give Joe a lot of credit for, you know, giving me the confidence to move down there. And it was a huge move. It was, I mean, I've been terrified most of my life, but it never kept me from doing any things I wanted to do. And that was one of the times. I was absolutely terrified to go to New Orleans. You know, all the reputation that Fairgrounds has, you know, with their local Cajun riders and how tough they are, and, you know, how especially hard it would be for a female jock. And, you know, I can't say that they were wrong. When I went down there, I actually ended up winning the first race that I rode. And it might have even been, like, the first race of the meet that year in 2010. And so I won a race, and I think probably everybody thought that, you know, it was just kind of like a little bit of a fluke. And but then I continued to win, and after about two or three weeks, it was like the riders down there, the guys were kind of like, okay, that's enough of this. And so they had like a gang up on Rosie week where, I mean, to me, it was like they were doing everything and anything to prevent me from winning. And it even seemed like they would set races up for each other just so that I couldn't win them. And maybe that wasn't true, but that's what it was seeming like to me. And I had guys put me in tight and trying to intimidate me, and I kind of just kept my mouth shut, and it was pissing me off. I mean, I was going home to Joe, and, like, you know, I was just so mad. It was just like, because, I mean, it was like you can't start a war. You can't really, you know, get mad about it and start, you know, complaining and this and that. So I just, you know, kind of kept my mouth shut and rode a little bit defensively for a while, which is not the way I like to ride. But I just sort of pushed back and held my ground. And I think when they realized that, you know, I was going to be competitive and hold my own, they kind of left me alone. And I had a goal to win 30 races at the meet, and I ended up winning 110. So,
wow.
You know, it's just another obstacle overcome.
Well, they obviously didn't know you very well, Rosie, if they thought they could succeed in intimidating you, because not only did you have 110 wins, but you were also the first woman jockey to win the Louisiana Derby and the first woman rider to win the leading rider title. How did that feel to accomplish that after the difficulties in the beginning you faced? How was it?
That was really, I mean, it was unreal. To win the Louisiana Derby, you know, it was my first $1 million race. It was my first Derby prospect who, like, you know, I was shocked when they asked me to, you know, ride in the Derby, in the Kentucky Derby. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening to me. It was all, I mean, that whole winter, that meet, the, you know, the Louisiana Derby, the Kentucky Derby, it was all a whirlwind. I mean, it was all like, my life is starting now, you know? And it was amazing. I mean, it gave me incredible opportunities. And, you know, Joe was right there the whole time, you know, telling me, you're good enough. You are really good. So stop, you know, pretending like you don't belong here. And so, I mean, it was intimidating, like I said, riding with those guys and you know, going into the Derby and, you know, acting like I belong, because it's where I wanted to be, and I just had to convince myself that it's where I belonged.
Well, you most certainly belonged, Rosie. And you did follow that horse, Pants on Fire, to the Derby. What was that like to be only the sixth woman to ride in the Derby, also best placed by a female? What was that like riding out to the track to the tune of My Old Kentucky Home?
It was amazing. And, you know, everybody before the race, I can't remember what some of the jocks that told me, you know, everyone says, like, no matter who you are, you will get emotional when they play My Old Kentucky Home. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I mean, that's not really the kind of person I am. Like, I wouldn't expect to, but if everybody does, I'm sure I will. And so when we got out on the track and they played My Old Kentucky Home, it really didn't do anything for me. But it was when the song was over and the crowd is amazing, you know, singing this melody all in unison, and there's so many people. I mean, there nobody gets the view of the Kentucky Derby like the post-parade view. I mean, it is absolutely jaw-dropping experience. But it was when the song was over and the melody stopped and the crowd just breaks into this roar and all the horses in the post parade are spinning out and, you know, getting worked up and nervous, and Pants on Fire was like cool as a cucumber. But we were watching, I think, Stay Thirsty got loose from the pony in front of us, and there was a shot on NBC on the coverage of me like laughing, and I was laughing because all the horses were freaking out. And it was just, like, you know, totally unexpected. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I was like, wow, this is what it's actually like. But it was the crowd that, like, you know, got me a little teary-eyed, like, holy cow, this is where we are. And it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. And then when we were warming up in the post parade, we were down on the turn by the 3/8 pole. And Ramon Dominguez looks over at me and he goes, this is crazy, isn't it? And I'm thinking, yeah, like, it was just really cool. It was cool to be out there with, you know, with all those guys and, you know, riding such a classy horse and at that level, and it's the Derby. It's, you know, it's every jockey's dream, I guess. And, you know, honestly, I think I rode it very well. And I tried to ride it, you know, as much like any other race as you possibly could. And I really got a great trip, on Pants on Fire, and, I've never been a big female, you know, well, I say that and people will not believe me, but I've never been like a big female activist and, you know, calculating all the first female things that I've done. But I have to admit that I was counting the horses in front of me down the lane to see where I was finishing, to see if I would be the best finishing female in the Derby. And I was ninth that year, which actually I think was the best finish, but and then I finished it a couple years later on my loop.
Rosie, I am so sad to say we only have a few minutes left here to go, and I hate to skip over you on two Kentucky Oaks, Breeders' Cup, but I do want to ask you The 2014 Breeders' Cup distaff on Untappable. Of course, everyone knows that's when you announced your retirement, that you were pregnant with your son, Carson. How hard was that to say that out loud on live national television, that you were going to retire, and what emotions were you feeling?
Well, it wasn't planned announcement. As a matter of fact, I considered announcing it on TV, and then, I was just debating. I knew I was going to have to announce it that weekend because I wasn't going to ride after that weekend, but I didn't know how to do it. And, I decided I didn't want some big dramatic thing on TV. So actually right before that race, or, earlier that day, I texted my sister and I said, I think I'm just going to wait and put it out on DRF, on Sunday or something. And, then the filly won the race, and it was so storybook. It was just too good to be true for me. It was just really incredible. Like I said, when I rode my first race, if I had never left Pimlico, I wouldn't have known the difference. I was so excited to just be a jockey. So I never, could have imagined doing half the things that I did in my career, and being able to end it on a filly like that and winning a Breeders' Cup was amazing. And so it was very emotional, and I was like, people asked me when I decided to make the announcement, and I said, literally as the words were coming out of my mouth. So it was not a planned announcement, and I didn't want to make a big dramatic thing of it, but it was it was such a huge thing. It was because I knew what it meant to me, and nobody else knew because I was retiring. So it was huge.
Perfect ending to an incredible career, Rosie. And dare I ask, I have to ask, is it the ending? Will you maybe make a comeback one day?
Well, I can tell you I don't plan on it.
Well, there we go.
Most people don't believe me when I say that. Maybe it's not true, but I don't plan on it.
Well, we'll see what happens, folks. Unfortunately, Rosie, we are all out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, Rosie.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget, you can listen to replays of Jock Talk at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time for another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.